I've been having a ton of fun with that, seeing a lot of people build their rental portfolios quickly, particularly young people. I really enjoy seeing young people grow their rental portfolios because, as you know, time is by far your biggest ally in real estate investing.
Real estate is about freedom, choice freedom, time freedom, and money freedom, and the impact you can make with that freedom. But it doesn't come without cost. Your freedom takes work. That's why Neil Timmons brings together the tools you need to build your real estate legacy, from tips and tricks to interviews with industry titans. It's all here in one place. Real Grit. Let's get to it.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Real Grit. I'm Neil Timmons. I'm here with Jack Bevier. He joined the Dominion Group back in 2007. He's worked in nearly every aspect of single family investment, including acquisitions, construction, property management, marketing, sales, business development, and finance. So we're going to have a deep conversation with him here, given the breadth of his experience. He's helped build Dominion Financial Services into a nationally recognized private lender for experienced real estate investors. He graduated from University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. He's a co-founder of Baltimore's nonprofit trade organization for real estate investors, the Small Developers Collective. So I'm happy to have him here. Jack, how are you?
Hey, Neil, great to see you, man. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate having you making the time. It's exciting to have you here. You have done absolutely everything in real estate. You've run the gamut of the whole business, but where did you start?
Yeah, so I started Dominion back in 2007. I joined my partner, Fred Lewis, who founded the company in 2002. I actually interned there, had a great time interning as a college student. I did commercial real estate for a couple of years after school. And then joined Dominion to do acquisitions. Seemed like a good idea in the middle of 2006 to go start buying houses, and joined Dominion in 07, and market really took a downturn. And did nothing but workouts and tried to catch a falling knife with real estate prices going down for the next 4 years. It was a great experience, worked a ton, and fortunately made it through it. And that was a real like kind of crucible for the company and also for my own kind of professional development. And just worn a lot of different hats across the companies as we've grown the platform since we were able to make it through the downturn. And been having a lot of fun, really just enjoy the business.
Going through kind of at the front end of your career, going through the downturn, what was the biggest challenge for you personally and professionally going through that?
Oh man, what wasn't a challenge at that time, right? Like every month, real estate, the market got softer, real estate prices kept going down. And yet we had to find a way to continue to bring in cash flow while real estate prices were going down. And as you were working your way out of deals that you'd already, the mistakes that you'd already made, yeah, you had to work your way out of them, but keep the bills paid, keep finding new business that was good, keep cash flow coming in to pay for the mistakes that you'd made.
Right.
And so that was a tremendous challenge, especially as the market was moving down and you didn't know where new revenue was coming from really.
Yeah.
But you did know that the stuff that you had done yesterday got you in trouble. So it was finding new niches, finding new ways to add value and developing new skills, all the while paying for your old mistakes was just a really lots of twists and turns and a very challenging period of time.
Your revenue streams at that time, what were they, say, as a percentage of overall revenue? What percentage was the buy and hold portfolio versus flipping versus new construction or whatever you were doing at that point in time?
Yeah, sure. So we've always bought houses, renovated them, and either kept them as rentals or sold them. We've also always been a wholesaler at the same time, again, to help make cash flow work.
Sure.
And bills. And then the lending company has been along the whole time. I would say it was probably half lending. The model of Dominion to have that kind of diversity of income streams was that the idea being that some of them are going to be up when others are down. And to help cash flow work, our goal has always been to grow the rental portfolio. But rental portfolio makes money in the long term and loses money from a cash flow point of view. You know, it sucks cash in while you're building it.
Correct.
And so we were flipping and wholesaling and lending money to create current income to afford the payroll and staff and overhead associated with adding new rentals. And so that balancing act of cash flow, really cash flow management, I think was probably the most challenging aspect of that.
Yeah.
And letting stuff go could have been a great rental deal, but you just needed the cash. And so we made the decision to wholesale something. Wish we'd never sold anything, right? Real estate values have gone and how asset prices have moved up. But cash flow demands what it demands. And so you have to strike that balancing act along the way.
The staff that you had at the time, what was the staff level at that time?
Yeah, back then, I think it was 6 or 7 people. Fred running the show. We had a property manager, 2 people in accounting, assistant property manager, and a construction person. I was in the field doing acquisitions. And so small, tight-knit group, great people, but difficult circumstances. And so as there were crises in each of those departments, so to speak, each of those areas of business jumped in where I had to help keep the train on the tracks.
Need more leads? Who doesn't, right? Want access to the vacant home list, absentee owners, tax liens, pre-foreclosures that are all routinely updated? Well, you can get it all in one place. Batchleads.io. Batchleads gives you nationwide property search, nationwide buyer search, comparable home sales, quick filters, and hundreds of prospect filters to allow you to slice and dice it any which way you wish. Batchleads is trusted by some of the nation's top real estate investors. And with plans starting as low as $30 a month, there's a lot of bang for the buck. Batchleads includes unlimited list stacking, so there's never a need to buy another program or figure it out in Excel. They even include discounted skip tracing with every single plan. It's the system my team and I personally use. Use coupon code IMPACT when checking out for 50% off your first month. Batchleads.io, coupon code IMPACT for 50% off your first month. Now, fast forward to today for the audience's sake. What's the staff population, if you will? What's that look like?
Yeah, so we've been growing the businesses, of course. The real estate, the property management staff is about 20. Real estate, which is acquisitions, construction management, marketing and sales, and kind of accounting and HR, is another 25. And then the lending company has 95 people in it now. A lot of that lending growth has been over the past couple of years, past 2 or 3 years, which ironically were a great time to be in the lending business.
Right.
Never really saw that one coming, but saw an opportunity a couple of years ago and really jumped in to that force. But I would say when I started in this business, I was 23 and driving around inner city Baltimore looking at houses, I had a crowbar. The crowbar is still in the back of my car, and driving around, how, you know, making offers and doing deals was fun thing that I wanted to do. Like, that's why I got into the business.
Yeah.
And today it's a lot more about people management and like developing culture and strategic planning. So always still been very operational, but definitely a job description has changed over the years quite a bit.
What would you say had to change about you personally to go from 23 years old in the car buying houses to being a leader of a very significant organization with lots of folks looking to you for leadership, candidly?
Yeah, that was a ride that we didn't, Fred and I, don't think Fred and I, neither of us realized what we were getting ourselves into as we, you know, we were just being entrepreneurial and said, hey, that sounds fun. Let's go take advantage of this opportunity,
right?
Like, get it. But what that required of us was for us to be able to kind of grow as investors and, like you said, kind of really leaders in the company, to bring up staff, put the right people in the right chairs, figure out a methodology to do that well, and try to build an organizational culture, which he told us that's what that meant for us. I'm sure we didn't know what we were getting ourselves into. But yeah, just being very introspective along the way has been crucial to just understanding what we do well, what we don't do well as a company, and frankly, as personally, you know, what kind of leader I should be requires, I think, a deep level of introspection to understand what kind of person you are and where your strengths are going to be and where your weaknesses absolutely are going to be.
Yeah.
And being able to fill those holes, people who fill those gaps, and understanding that like interpersonal conflict is going to happen, and figuring out how to manage those relationships and frankly yourself to do what's best for the organization and keep things really moving forward. Because it's not always what's fun. You know, if you wake up every morning as a leader, think you're the leader of an organization, you wake up in the morning and say, hey, I'm in charge. I want to do what I want because I'm in charge. Well, the company's growth is going to be stunted by your own inability to be introspective and realize what your faults are. And I think a lot of companies do reflect that. They are images of their leaders' strengths and weaknesses. But to like get beyond that level, I think that happens when you are honest with yourself about your weaknesses and start filling those with other people who have those areas of strengths.
Yeah.
That's when you can make those additional moves forward.
With having nearly 150 employees, how important is culture to your business?
Extremely. Both from even 4 or 5 years ago, I knew everyone's name and spouse's name and kid's name. At this point, it just like becomes, when you're hiring 5 people a week, just it's almost physically impossible to kind of keep up with that. And therefore, having that culture in place is necessary so that new people coming in understand what True North is, And if you don't set that for them, then you'll just get a bunch of random people not really rowing in the same direction. So we've done a lot more. Zoom has been actually really helpful the past couple of years in terms of us being able to stay in front of employees and build that culture. But getting that consistent, at least weekly FaceTime with everybody so that they see what we're saying, how we're saying it, what matters to us, like on those calls is really important, because without it, then they're disconnected and frankly, they just don't know which way to row. You know, it can be great people, but they just don't know where we're trying to head with this thing. That aspect of culture building has been something that has been a big focus for me the past 2 years. And frankly, it doesn't come natural with my personality at all. It's been something that I've worked on. I had to work on a lot. Like, I'm a deal guy. I'm very analytical. I like winning. I'm very competitive. But I'm not the guy holding court at happy hour. So, and I'm not like, I've seen a lot of companies where there's like a cult, you know, it's like a cult of personality around a big personality. And that person can then drive the culture forward very well. Those personality types tend to have other weaknesses, like systems and processes.
Right.
But there's a real culture there. For me, we have fantastic systems and processes, but I've really had to work on developing culture, because otherwise it's like a machine without a soul. And people don't want to work at those kind of places. So that's been a big challenge for me personally, frankly. That's a function of like being honest with yourself about who you are and who you are not.
Spot on. And then a lot of times hiring to those and while improving where you can.
Yeah, we went through an exercise, which at the beginning of it, I thought was a little fluffy, of like identifying core values for the company. Yeah. But as we really got into that, and like when you really commit to it and get into it, it is not fluffy. It is very challenging. It is demanding. And it's incredibly important, because then having a model, having a framework really crystallizes decisions, which even leaders need reminders of what the true north is. Particularly as you're growing.
When you put it down and commit to it, it is deeply impactful, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Using core values and mission statement, as fluffy as those words sound to me, like using those as the lens to make decisions keeps you on track in times of stress and times of adversity. So, you know, something that I used to think was cheesy and now I think is crucial and essential to, you know, success.
Talk to me about the lending business that you run. Essentially, as I understand it, there's two sides of the lending business, or maybe two types of borrowers. Is that fair?
Yeah. So we have like two core products. Both, everything's focused on distressed residential real estate, or rather just in residential investment real estate. And we do fix and flip loans, short-term acquisition and construction loans secured by residential properties. We lend nationwide. We're everywhere. I'm adding Nevada. So I'm in 49 states right now. I'm hoping to tack on the 50th over the summer. And the value proposition there is really speed and service. We want to work with professional real estate investors who have done this before, who have some operating capital, who have good financials, but they need somebody who they can call on Monday and close on Wednesday. And that is where we distinguish ourselves, as being able to close very quickly. We do internal underwriting, so we don't have to wait for appraisals. And that allows us to close a loan, I think, faster than anybody else in the country. So that's been a bread and butter business for us for a long time. Really, really enjoy that business. Frankly, we just like our borrowers. You know, real estate entrepreneurs are just kind of like our kind
of total
pros,
right? Yeah.
And so I have a lot of fun seeing those deals, talking to those borrowers, and seeing them succeed ultimately. Yeah. And then we added a rental loan product, debt service coverage ratio, DSCR loan, which is really for landlords who are building their rental portfolios. So it's typically a 30-year fixed rate loan. Kind of the fastball is like a 75% LTV cash out. Someone buys a house, renovates it, and is looking to refinance and try to get as much of their hard costs back out of that. It's got no seasoning period. So that's great for professional real estate investors who are really like using that product to refinance properties as they come off the assembly line and lock in a 30-year term. You never have to you don't have to deal with a local banker process, and you never have to go back to them every 5 or 10 years for a new proctological.
That's an incredible product for those who specialize in largely in BRRRR strategy, bringing these things through, as you call it, the assembly line, buy it, fix it, rent it, put it on a 30-year fixed rate. These are not hitting your personal credit scores. These aren't Fannie Freddie loans. You're not capped at 10. You got an unlimited amount. Is that fair?
Yeah, all that.
Yeah. And you just rinse and repeat the thing.
Yeah, exactly right. A lot of fun of that. I've been having a ton of fun. Again, with our borrowers, seeing a lot of folks who are young and aggressive and who want to grow their rental portfolios quickly. We were frankly growing. We've got a 750 single family property rental portfolio that we grew using the BRRRR method over 20 years, we were always kind of constrained by our local banks.
By capital, you know, sure.
They wanted to understand the global debt service coverage ratio was and how the different sides of the business were going. And just from a cultural point of view, banks are a little bit slower than real estate entrepreneurs. I think it's fair to say that. With his DSCR loan, since it was designed for real estate investors, and frankly, is being originated by companies like mine who are geared towards that core customer base, it creates an environment where they can move a lot faster. And so there's guys, my office is in Baltimore. So there's local guys here that I know just from seeing them at the courthouse steps who are adding 20, 30 rentals a year over the past couple of years, which is a pace that like we didn't achieve for years and years and years.
Yeah.
But the product is really kind of designed for that as opposed to a bank who looks at it as a commercial loan and doesn't view your business as the manufacturing pipeline, the factory, which is like how we think about it. So I've been having a ton of fun with that, seeing a lot of people build their rental portfolios quickly, particularly young people.
Yeah.
Really enjoy seeing young people grow their rental portfolios because, as you know, time is by far your biggest ally in real estate investing.
Well, for all the things you said, they can also build it faster because they achieve greater cash flow. Because I know when I go to my commercial bank, I have never gotten a 30-year amortization on anything, let alone a 30-year fixed rate. So you do it with greater certainty. Most commercial banks are at 5 years. If you're good with somebody really well, maybe you get a 10-year fixed rate,
right?
But you're not getting past that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We went with our own portfolio, we refinanced about 2/3 of it into this product because it's just a better option.
Right. All right. So you and I are recording this at the end of May, 2022. Looking back to December to today, the 10-year treasury has practically doubled. And interest rates are moving. The Fed has signaled additional increases. So talk to me about what you're seeing in the single family side. How's that going to play out? And then also on the commercial side, what you're seeing, what you're hearing in that world.
Yeah, sure. First quarter was a real whirlwind with rates increasing as much as they did, as quickly as they did.
As fast, yeah.
In kind of the folks we talked to in the mortgage business refer to that as a violent movement, that quick, that fast. And I think that it certainly has affected debt service coverage, right? If you're a fix and flip investor, 100 to 200 basis point increase in rates, you get a little bit concerned that there might be some softness in the homeowner market. So I'm really looking forward to seeing this live and seeing where the market is a month from now. But maybe we're starting to see a little bit of softness right now, but it's not good. But your cost of capital isn't going to affect the viability of your fix and flip deal. You're looking for 20, 30% annual margins in that business model.
Yep.
So you want to get your cost of capital down as low as possible. But a 200 basis point increase in that is not a break.
You're primarily concerned about where the resale is when you get done with the product.
Yeah, exactly. As a landlord, though, debt service coverage is your money, right? Like you're making the spread between the return on asset and the cost of debt. And so if the cost of debt is up 250 basis points and you don't see an increase in cap rates to correspond with that, which to this point in residential, we really have not seen that. I think in larger multifamily deals above 20 million, you've seen maybe a 5 to 10% decrease in nominal prices in that real institutional side of thing. But that's much more like the spreadsheet says what it says, and no one's making decisions outside of that. But for residential real estate, and I think also, as you mentioned, for commercial real estate classes, just really haven't seen much degradation in asset value prices to allow investors to get better cap rates. So right now, the investor is just getting squeezed and or counting on additional rent increases. And that's, I think, where rents are going to go from here, given that we've just had two big years of rent increases. I think it's still a hotly debated subject as to whether we're going to continue to see rent increases. We may not. I see both sides of that coin. I don't have a very strong opinion on that subject right now. But what I do know is that at the moment, people who bought these deals 4 months ago got to this point, went to refinance, thought they were going to be refinancing at 4.5 and they're refinancing at 6.5, you're squeezed. You know, you got squeezed there.
It seems to me like there's a tremendous amount of cash. The government obviously injected a tremendous amount of liquidity into the environment, and there's just a lot of cash. And what you're saying is that the cap rates are not moving. So the investor's getting squeezed, i.e. they're accepting a lower rate of return than what they would have 6 months ago to buy a deal. It has not yet moved at this point.
Yeah, which is very interesting. Are investors just accepting a lower levered return for being in an inflation protected asset class?
Right.
And that's just where the market's willing to be. or are we going to see rent increases, or are we going to see asset prices come down, or are we going to see interest rates come back down? But right now, I think the story is that we are in this moment that is not in equilibrium, right? Something has got to give. This cannot keep up for the long term. And I'm really interested to see how the rest of the summer plays out, because I don't know which way it's going to go.
No, the Fed continues to drive forward. As they said, they intend to do so. They continue to increase interest rates. Wow. What's going to continue to happen? And obviously the eyes are inflation too, to see if that could level off. Is it going to pull down? Are we going back up?
Yeah.
If there's real wage growth, one could make the argument, if there's real wage growth, that you can have rental increases.
Well, no, I saw an interesting stat. It was data published by the Atlanta Fed that broke apart inflation by quartile of wages.
And
it showed basically that, you know, the white collar workers were, their wage increases were almost keeping up with inflation.
Right.
As you broke that down and got into the lower quartiles, which tend to be more of your renter segment of the economy, their wages were definitely not keeping up with inflation. And so then, you know, that puts pressure, right? Like affordability is down, and affordability is even more down because their percentage of the discretionary income, rent, has gone up even relative to other people in the economy. So renters are particularly affected by these affordability issues.
As much as we say, hey, everybody's got to have a place to live, that while that's true, it doesn't mean it's your place.
Yes, that's right.
Like, what I'm certain of is they are absolutely going to eat, right?
Yeah.
Believe it or not, there is a bunch of things that get stacked in front of that. And there is a point where they run up against affordability in how much can you actually raise the rent at that lower third or lower quartile.
Yeah. One point that I think is interesting is the other aspect of that is that consumption can go down, consumption of housing. And by that, I mean that, and historically, this many people per household is not historically normal levels, right? Like, we are consuming more housing, more square feet of housing
per person,
per human, per American than we have in the past. And maybe that's what has to change, right? Affordability hits the ceiling, and it's not that rents come down. You just get less square footage for the money that you're spending. And household size goes from whatever it is right now, 3.5 humans per household.
I think that's a very viable argument. It's been increasing decade over decade since, I want to say, the 1950s, the last piece I read on this. Now we're in an environment where the cost of construction is the highest ever been. I mean, there's significant constraints to construction at this point.
Right.
That would make a lot of sense.
I think that is kind of the concerning scenario, that if replacement cost is going up and incomes aren't going up enough, rents must go up. And incomes aren't going up enough to keep up with rents going up. Well, you just put another human in, you know, the rent is per house, right?
Right. Yeah.
So, like, put another income into that house, and all of a sudden you board it. It just means that everybody is consuming less housing per capita. That scenario would allow rents to continue to go up to kind of balance that equation. But that means lifestyle changes, right? That means quality of life and lifestyle change for how Americans consume housing. And maybe that's what we have in store.
You're looking forward, your thoughts on commercial real estate, you know, the next year to 5 years. Commercial real estate is different in many regards from residential real estate, principally from how they're financed. A lot of 5, 7, 10 year rate adjustments have to take place, come off in balloons. And with rates rising, you know, looking forward a couple of years from now to go, well, guys borrowed at sub-4 rates 6 months ago to 3 years ago. Now, all of a sudden, you're at 5+, mid-5, somewhere in that kind of range going forward on a refinance if you've got to do something. How do you think that plays out? What do you think the impact just in the global commercial space looks like?
I think the timing of those resets and those balloons is going to be really interesting and maybe drive some behavior that you wouldn't normally expect. As you said, if your lender's got a gun to your head and you come up on that 5-year balloon and they say, no, just get out, and then you run the math and you go to refinance and the rates are 200 basis points higher, and you calculate debt service coverage and they say, you know what, we can't actually get you out of this principal. You need to actually go bring some cash to the table for us to be able to refi this deal. Doing a capital call to investors versus then just making the decision, you know what, we're just going to sell the asset, I think might lean some people towards that latter direction. I think that's the case in some commercial real estate sectors, as well as multifamily, where operators haven't been able to hit the pro forma increase, that operating income that they expected, combined with bullet in a higher interest rate environment, that may lead to some forced selling and or, and I think in the case of like very poor operating scenarios, maybe even some kind of distress situations. I don't think that we're going to see like a wave of distress and like asset dumping, but I do think that there's going to be situational distress. And that's something that we're being cognizant of, is to have both cash and personal bandwidth, just mental bandwidth, to be able to take advantage of those opportunities if and when the phone does ring. Because if we're distracted into chasing some new shiny object, whether we've got the cash or not, we don't have the energy to go tackle that scenario. And that might be a better energy from a risk return point of view.
I've got a question for you. Are you enjoying the podcast? I sure hope you are. And if you are, may I ask your personal favor? Would you mind going to iTunes and leaving a written review and a 5-star review? If you do that, send me a screenshot to my office. I want to send you back a list as a thank you. It's a list of the top 20 best lists to market to in order to find motivated sellers. This list has been curated by my office over years of direct marketing to sellers. This will either shortcut your path to finding the best list to start marketing to, or it's sure to add to what's already working. You can send that screenshot of your review to marketing@realgritpodcast.com. That's marketing@realgritpodcast.com. I think you said two things that are, I think, are vitally important. I think from what you said relative to being forced to sell or being forced with a decision, do we bring equity to the table just to refinance and keep our asset or indeed liquidate? I think that may lend itself or maybe the catalyst to hit equilibrium in the commercial market because they're going to be forced to go to market at some sort of prevailing current situation, right? Maybe by the time that occurs, a tremendous amount of the cash will have been deployed that's sitting on the sidelines today. That, and then I think the old saying, when there's blood in the streets, buy property. All of us look back to 2009, 10, 11, 12, and we should have bought everything, but most of us didn't. Most of us didn't have the intestinal fortitude to do it because times were scary back in those era. And plenty of people, I mean, there was plenty of money could have been deployed and just wasn't deployed. So what do you think is going to be different, or what are you preparing for to be mentally prepared if an opportunity, maybe not that extreme, but opportunities arrive and it's dark outside, it's scary, that you've got the intestinal fortitude to actually take the action to move forward?
Yeah, it is difficult to do that in those situations because the question that's in the back of your head that you're asking yourself is, maybe the world is just different now. You know, like maybe this isn't cyclical. Maybe there has been a fundamental shift.
Right.
And we don't really have those deep dips unless people are asking themselves that question. Like that is the question that evokes the level of fear in humans necessary for them to not take advantages of opportunities, right? Like they really have to be having a crisis of an existential crisis to sit on the sidelines when cap rates are presumably good. And as you put it, it takes a great deal of intestinal fortitude to jump in when people are having that kind of existential crisis. And right now, on a going forward basis, you know, kind of given what's going on globally, given what's going on from a technology point of view, particularly as it relates to commercial real estate and how technology may impact commercial real estate over the next 10 years, I think that there may be a point where people really ask themselves, given what's going on in technology, like, do we really need all this real estate? You know, like, is the office building as dead as we know it? You know, there were certainly points of time where certain commercial real estate became unviable. There were barns with horse stalls all over the country at one point, and then the automobile just completely destroyed that, the need for that. It comes up as a different form, of course.
Malls come to the recent mind, right?
Yeah.
The shopping mall, there's been a complete change and away from that.
Yeah. And there's lots of conflicting opinions on it. There's strong opinions on both sides by very smart people on both sides. And so I think that kind of doubt and that kind of fear leads to those kind of opportunities. Frankly, one of the reasons I got into residential real estate is that I kind of feel warm and fuzzy every night that knowing that like I'm providing something that people literally need to keep themselves safe. And so it's a less sexy sometimes, you know, it's less sexy of an asset class sometimes and can be a little bit lower or are generally lower than commercial real estate because the risk profile is lower. I got a lot of risk tolerance operationally, but in terms of like the asset class, I got a warm blanket on that I'm in residential real estate.
No matter what it is that you do or invest in, you've got to sleep well at night. So it needs to mask your risk tolerance no matter. I mean, yeah, you probably go dig for oil or do a whole bunch of things that may strike it rich. I'm with you. There's a bunch of things I couldn't do because I couldn't sleep well.
Yeah.
I want to move on to a final segment, what I call 4-4 impact.
4-4 impact.
Your favorite quote, success seems to be largely a matter of hanging on others or hanging on after others have let go. William Feathers said it. That plays right into our previous conversation. So what about that resonates most with you?
Yeah, that was my quote when I was in my high school yearbook. When they asked you for a quote picture, that was it. Success to me seems in large part hanging on after others have let go. We've definitely found that. I think that was a big driver for me to get into real estate investing at a young age. I understood the concept of compound interest and that time was my biggest friend there. And particularly in residential real estate, which in and of itself is a relatively safe asset class, I don't perceive that, particularly in a more affordable segment of real estate, I go wake up in the morning and take a lot of risk. I just go do work. Just roll your sleeves up and do whatever work needs to be done to find deals and operate that real estate. And eventually, over time, I love that real estate is inflation hedged because incomes go up, rents go up, costs go up, incomes go up, rents go up. And the idea that all I had to do was just keep doing it for a long time, work on building a nice operation, a nice machine, and time would take care of the success factor there. And we decided to focus on residential real estate and put our heads down, not get distracted with shiny objects. There were lots of opportunities over the past 15 years that we didn't do and opportunities that we missed that we could have done. But the idea was just keep your head down, get really good at one area of investing. And the idea that, that rising rents and compound interest and compound returns will take care of the heavy lifting for you is just one that suits my personality.
What do you think it is that holds most investors back from hitting their personal next level?
I think that the decisions that we make have more ramifications, and the decisions that we make when we're young, significant ramifications, frankly, our ability, our bandwidth, that issue to invest. It's really hard to jump into investing, which is running a small business. That is what it's
like
when you're starting out. So the idea of having a full-time job, you have a family and a full-time job, and then you're going to start a small business on the side. Oh my God. Like, there's not enough hours in the day, frankly. And I think that it is hard to make it through the ups and downs of just holding down a job, much less spending time in raising a family, much less starting a new business.
Yeah.
And the longer you wait, the harder it becomes to actually make that decision and then stick with that decision because time is necessary. No one gets 2 years isn't enough time, 5 years isn't enough time, maybe 10. But it's a 10-year decision to get into real estate investing. And I think a lot of people don't realize that it is a 10-year decision and or they're not able to hold on for 10 years to actually see the fruits of that success.
Outside of real estate, what are you most passionate about?
I am married, no children, but spend a lot of time with my wife. We travel a lot. That's my favorite thing to do. My sister has two kids, my niece and nephew, Sadie and Wyatt. So I love spending time with them. They're wonderful. I started sailing like 8 years ago and I race sailboats a couple times a week. It's like, it's my me time. There's no phones on the boat. When you're focused on racing, it's like I both get some competitive outlet as well as it's just wonderful to be on the water. So those are how I spend my time outside.
That's great. The last question, what's your favorite way to make an impact in the community?
So you mentioned that in the intro that I've been part of the board of this Small Developers Collective, which is a nonprofit trade organization that we put together. Basically, the idea is, there's a lot of mom and pop investors who are doing a lot of impact. I live in Baltimore, and there's a lot of need for housing redevelopment here. And there's a lot of work that's done by small mom and pop investors that you never hear about, you never see on TV, you don't read about it in the paper, but it's thousands of units being renovated every year by very small businesses. They get almost no attention. And so putting the Small Developers Collective, helping to get that formed and move it forward, gave me an opportunity to kind of highlight the great work that is done by real estate investors as small developers all across the country. That's really grassroots community redevelopment.
Yep.
And support small businesses at the same time. Like I just think that should be encouraged more and should be highlighted and we should be encouraging that kind of activity, that kind of entrepreneurial activity combined with community redevelopment. It's all good. Anyway, that was something that when I got the opportunity to help start that 5 or 6 years ago, that's been a great outlet for me to be able to give back.
I couldn't agree more. There's so many of us involved in exactly same line of work you do, fix and flip into rentals. And we're changing the way and structures in which people live in and how they live and changing the face of a city at the same time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, I really appreciate you taking the time to connect here. This has been a great conversation. For people who want to learn more about you, where can they connect? Or if they want to learn about how they can connect with the business on the finance side, how can they do so?
Yeah, sure. My email address is jack@thedominiongroup.com. And our website is www.dominionfinancialservices.com. And yeah, be happy to connect with anybody. If they're looking for loans, if they just want to talk shop, I love doing that. So really enjoyed the conversation here today, Neil. Really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Hey, all the links that Jack just referenced there and the email address will be down in the show notes so anybody can find it there. I appreciate the time, Jack. Thanks a ton.
Yep, thank you.
Hey, for everybody here, Real Grit, I'm Neil Timmons, reminding you that real estate requires real grit. See you next time.
If you like our content and want more, you can access it at realgritpodcast.com. You hear it guest after guest. Instinctively, you already know it. But let me call it out. The most expensive action is inaction. The real estate market is full of opportunities. You just need to uncover them. You can build a business that lasts for years, makes monumental impact in the lives of those that you love. It's not just about business, but about the freedom you get because of it. Have you ever heard the saying, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. I believe that partnering is essential. In fact, I partner with hardworking investors all the time. The point is that you can get a lot further with the right partner. Let me say it again, the right partner. If you've ever thought about partnering with anyone, or if you have a partner now, I encourage you to download my free Partner and Profit Guide, which includes the top 5 must answer questions to evaluate a profitable partnership. You can find it at www.legacyimpactpartners.com. I'll see you in the next episode.